Hello. Yeah. Okay. Now we're really live. I think it's telling me. And hello out there, folks, whoever you are, wherever you are, we're broadcasting on the Facebook page of KBOO Community Radio and the Facebook page of Popular Resistance, along with various other places on YouTube, Twitter, Twitch, somewhere else I'm forgetting. And this is David Rovix, and this is Fifth Estate Live, which comes to you every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, and is archived at fifthestate.org, where you can also become a subscriber to the Fifth Estate magazine, which comes out 4 times a year in print, and all kinds of great archive stuff up on the website there as well. And also for people who subscribe these days, now there are special deals to get a copy of Peter Werby's new novel, which is a fantastic novel about Detroit 1967. It takes place around that period, that summer, in fact, Summer on Fire. And today I'm very happy to be spending the hour with longtime organizer, old friend of mine and many others who are watching now. And of course, they just started construction work outside. That's always what they do as soon as I start broadcasting. But hopefully it's, I think it's being filtered out by the filter here. But anyway, we are spending the hour with Karen Pickett, a longtime organizer with Earth First and with the movement more broadly, and who is currently involved with the Earth First Journal Collective, reviving it and keeping it going, and intermittently working on a book. Karen Pickett, it's great to have you. And Karen has sent, you've sent workshop outlines, which I've never attended one, but the outline is fantastic. And it's just like, we were talking about what to talk about. And I was kind of wanting to, get a little bit of an overview of the history of the past several decades of Earth First, which is of course a huge thing to take on. But it's also like, I'm kind of thinking, especially about some of the, probably the majority of the people who ever have the time to watch these interviews, which are on the younger side generally, a lot of folks who don't know a lot of things about, like, say, the bombing of Judy Berry and, Redwood Summer, or and don't realize that a lot of the tactics that they themselves may be involved with, as with so many of us who have been involved with all kinds of different stuff, we don't know where these things came from. And some of the tactics of Earth First, tactics and strategies predate Earth First as well. But a lot of stuff was pioneered by Earth First, I'd say, that are tactics, strategies, and thoughts that have sort of kept with us in so many different ways since then. And I'm just trying to introduce the subject here in my own way. I hope I'm doing it. So there, then I'm just going to throw it to you. What do you think? Am I doing okay at kind of setting the stage for this discussion?
Yeah. It sounds great. And it's funny when you mentioned the construction outside, just as an aside, there's a chipper truck that's kind of roaring at the bottom of my trail here, where that's chipping the brush that we have cleared in my little rural area here for fire safety. And so that's my morning music in part, but there's a lot of bird song around here too, so that's great. But yeah, it is a lot to, the history is a lot to put into a capsule, as it were, but it's also on the one hand, it's important for movements that have been around for a long time to do that in certain ways and periodically, because there's always an evolution. And I think that's the most important lens to look at things through is how things have evolved and, how things are evolving and look to the roots, which we may not necessarily be defined by, but there they are, they're part of the story. And it's also a good time to look at the history because we happen to be, we're now in the 41st year of the movement and the Earth First Journal. And we were publishing the 40th anniversary issue of the Earth First Journal. It was in production just about 1 year ago last spring, and it got derailed. And that's a whole story unto itself, but we're back working on it, and it's still the anniversary issue because it is a good time to just, you know, look at the whole, that whole scope and revisit some of the issues.
Just to set the context of why I think this discussion is also so relevant, in addition to, like, you know, tactics and strategies and the relevance of movement history, is just like an environmental, in terms of the environment, like in terms of the forests. I mean, Earth First historically has been strongest as a network on the west coast of North America, I'd say, it's fair to say. And that's where these horrendous fires have been ravaging so much of the western part of the country, and then the solutions that are being offered by the powers that be are actually just making everything worse. And this is stuff that has been very well known by people like yourself for a very long time, and you guys have been, you know, making that very clear in so many different ways for so long. And in so many different ways, the chickens are coming home to roost, right? In terms of this kind of stuff. I hate to, to say, because it's such a sad fact, but it's a fact, right? I mean, we're facing absolutely tremendous calamity right now, and in this part of the world particularly. But anyway, that's just a little more kind of like where we're ending up in the discussion in the present moment of, like, the extreme relevance of everything that you guys have been doing, your whole adult life, basically.
Right. And yeah, in so many ways, it's amazing how, I mean, obviously not just in the Earth First movement or just in the environmental movement, but for all of those people involved in one form of struggle or another, it's amazing how often we find ourselves fighting the same battles, exactly the same battles. In the environmental movement, it can be an area or a species that was saved through litigation or passage of laws or whatever, and then there is the same issue back again because things get reversed. And it's essentially, as long as we're living in an anthropocentric age, and as long as we're living under capitalism, that is going to be the case, because the profiteers and the state will look for these openings, and they're opportunistic about it, and they'll keep coming back to these issues, these things that have been supposedly changed within the society and areas that have been saved. So there we are once again, and it's also a good reason to revisit the history, because then we have to look at, okay, the last time we fought this battle, what worked and what didn't, and just on a very
too, right. I mean, there were many times when you fight, you win, right? As the saying goes, where you fight a battle and you might not win the whole struggle around deforestation and whatever else, but if you're fighting a battle over a patch of land, that can be a victory in many different occasions.
Well, right. And often part of a campaign is, raising public awareness, because all this stuff goes on behind the scenes. So much goes on behind the scenes. And it's one of the reasons why, particularly in the early days, Earth First was known for its antics and, dressing up in animal costumes and invading boardrooms and public hearings and that sort of thing. And, just singing funny songs and taking over the podium. And it can look like theater, but that's what gets attention. That's what gets the cameras clicking. And then there your picture is, you know, on the next day's page or, you know, in these days, the next morning's screen.
It's very reminiscent of the Yippies. And I guess was there a direct relationship there at the beginning with Earth First with the Yippies?
Yeah. The so-called founders, and it was just a small handful, were most of the people, you know, it was like five or six people. And most of them had worked for mainstream environmental organizations like the Wilderness Society and Friends of the Earth. And so their universe kind of revolved around Washington, D.C. I mean, you know, that's what people were taught is this is how you make change. You change laws and you lobby elected representatives and that's how you change those laws. And the people who had worked for those organizations got totally and completely fed up with the way that had come to be operating in the 80s, because in the early 80s, I mean, Earth First was founded in 1980, because the name of the game was compromise, and that was the only name of the game, and it was trade-offs everywhere. And but another of the founders, one of the founders, Mike Rozelle, who I was actually married to for a number of years, and he came from the Yippies. That was his background, and so he brought that to the table, to this table where this discussion, it was actually a camping trip in the desert. It wasn't exactly a table, but
great for discussion, much better than a table. the slogan "No Compromise in Defense of Mother Earth" was that a very early slogan in terms of the question of compromise, or was that later?
Well, yes, it was early. I mean, the basic tenets of Earth First were laid out very early on. I mean, initially there was just through this brainstorming around the frustration of people and thinking, okay, we know that there's another way to do this. How can we do it differently? And how can we have an impact by doing it differently? And so through that brainstorm, they came up with the name, you know, what we really want to do is put the earth first, not, you know, the next election first, or somebody's career first, or profits first. We put the earth first, period. End of sentence. And by the way, that sentence ends with an exclamation point. And during that same trip, Mike Rozelle drew the fist that became the green fist of Earth First. So that was right off the bat. But then, you know, it was just a few months later, people were still talking, and a set of principles was laid out and included what became the three basic tenets of Earth First, which is a stance of no compromise, and a willingness to engage in direct action, and an underlying philosophy of biocentrism. Those were the three tenets. And actually, it's interesting to note, to just leap ahead 40 years, the meeting that I was just at of a handful of Earth Firsters was talking about adding a fourth tenet, which is anti-colonialism. And which in today's world fits, I mean, it's, of course it's important, but it fits within the frame of the logic and the frame of the basic tenets as well.
And when did tactics like the tree sit, which I think, at least to whatever extent a lot of people know about Earth First, it's tactics like sitting in trees and tripods and these kinds of structures that basically risk the lives of the people engaging in this form of civil disobedience if people come to try to remove them from the trees or try to make a, you know, pass down the logging road that's being blocked by somebody hanging from a tripod and that sort of thing. I don't know how many people out there are familiar with those tactics, but they were very important tactics. And when did they start?
Still widely used. But that was the mid-80s. The first tree sit was in 1985, in central Oregon, in an old growth forest. And I mean, one of the things that few people know as well is that's kind of when the battle over old growth forest emerged, was in the mid 80s, and it was via Earth First actions, because they were high profile, very few people, but high profile. You know, things like people hanging off buildings. There was a banner hang on a Forest Service office in downtown Portland, and there were the tree sits. And there had been blockades out miles and miles in the wilderness. And all of these things were quite novel. And so the media picked up on them, and it was and had talked to people, and that's when what was at stake, the discussions around what was at stake came up. And, you know, it was the irreplaceable old growth and the species that depend on them. And there was a copy of the Oregonian newspaper that came out with an issue, and above the fold, there was a picture of the spotted owl. And that really launched the campaign to save old growth forests, because it was just something that people were not aware of. And you know, so many of the old growth forests, especially in the Pacific Northwest, were being cut on public land in the national forests. And so that came out, and that's what really launched the fight for old growth forests, because it wasn't really acceptable to anybody. You know, the Forest Service wasn't making money on it. It was the corporations that were making money on it, because they got sweetheart deals. And, you know, from whatever angle you looked at it, the only entities benefiting from this were the corporations, and everybody else was losing. So it was, and Earth First never got credit for that, but that has, you know, oftentimes in my look at Earth First history, Earth First has been the first clarion call and sometimes the last line of defense, and rarely gets credit for it, but that's not the point. Yeah. You know, the point is to talk about these things that are happening behind closed doors, and expose them, and then, you know, pull people out of the woodwork to fight on these issues. But that, you know, that's true of genetically engineered organisms. You know, we had this demonstration in, I think it was 1986, and people pulled strawberry plants that were being bred to withstand frost. It was a product called Frost Ban, and we had a press conference here with somebody dressed up as a mad scientist, and, you know, just had enough antics that we could pull the media out. And that was the first GMO demonstration. And we also had the first demonstration at the World Bank in 1986. And I was there and was part of a blockade where all we did was, I mean, the World Bank meeting was happening in DC that year. And all we did was line up in front of the doors, no technology. And we just linked arms, and there were probably a dozen of us. And the issue that we were putting forward was World Bank funding of rainforest destruction And Randy Hayes from the Rainforest Action Network was there, and Ponderosa Pine, and a lot of just amazing people from the past, most of whom are still alive. Then we got media coverage. We hung a Equal Rights for All Species banner on the Abe Lincoln sculpture. And nobody had protested the World Bank before. I mean, maybe they had like talked about it, you know, in these rooms in Washington, D.C., and people had done their lobbying, but nobody knew really what was going on. The public certainly didn't know. So there's a lot of examples like that. And
but the basic process is like the basic process you're describing that was effective on so many different occasions is a few people who are doing something involving high profile, as you describe it, which is generally involves some kind of an action, some kind of public art, statements, puppets, banners, and something having to do with breaking the law, something where there's risk involved. People are taking risks doing something illegal, and that combination of things, even with a small number of people, when you're talking about an issue that is actually popular among the broad array of the population, but they just don't necessarily know about it, this can really sway public opinion and impact policy, which is quite something. I mean, when you consider that the numbers of people you're talking about with these actions, as I've seen, you know, on so many occasions at Earth First actions in forests around the country, they're usually very small. I mean, but, you know, often still they can't be ignored easily because you're talking about people who are often in positions where their lives are at risk if the operation continues. And so people just have to deal with that. And that's which is, I mean, I've seen so many people almost get killed carrying out those kinds of actions. That's nonviolent civil disobedience, basically. But, you know, the people who want to log those forests or who are trying to carry out their, you know, go to work or whatever it is, they're, you know, they don't look at it like nonviolent civil. I don't know if that's in their vocabulary. All they see is people who are in their way, and it's, you know, they kill people. They almost run them over. I mean, you know, of course, people have died, but other people, so many occasions, people almost died, you know, with the aggressive driving. And we all these vehicular attacks on protests we're seeing over the past year, it's getting some press, not much, but, it, you know, should be getting a lot more press, but that's nothing new. No?
Right. And I think that, you know, the statement with the risk taking is number one, that it's, that this is worth it. You know, I'm sitting up here in this tree and with just a couple ropes holding me in because it's worth it. You know, yes, I'm risking my life, but it's worth it. And also the message is that there's something that people can do about these things that they see happening around them besides despair and the, you know, the old slogan, which is remains one of my favorite slogans, which is, you know, action is the antidote to despair. Because it really is.
It really is.
And people respond to that. And so that's something that a small group of people can do. And you know, it's not that people would choose to be in the way of a car speeding into a crowd of people and take a risk that way. But, you know, the point is when those things have happened, the next day people are out in the streets again. And that's the important thing.
Yeah. At the time, I mean, in the 80s, I mean, I know that I know what it felt like for me being a young adult in the 80s, and it was I felt very much like we were in the shadow of a much bigger social movement that had just kind of come and gone, and then hearing about actions involving smaller numbers of people, I know, like when you say action is the antidote for despair, I completely agree. But and I tell people that all the time in different ways. But at the time in the 80s, particularly with such small turnout and so many different actions, was it like emotionally dealing with that reality? I mean, did you feel optimistic regardless, or what was that like?
Well, I don't much use the word optimism or hope.
More like necessity.
It's worth it. I mean, for me personally, there's almost no separation between my political and personal life. And long ago I chose to live my life in a certain way, and this is my life. So I don't, weigh every action that I take necessarily. This is the agenda. This is the program. But I also, and where my ultimate faith, I do use the word faith, as opposed to hope, where my faith lies is not so much in the ability of people to make those changes necessarily, or that is somehow the saving grace, but I have a tremendous amount of faith in the regenerative powers of the earth herself. And I think, I mean, maybe I'm exposing myself as a bit of a somewhat misanthropic biocentrist, which I am, and I'm settled with, but that's where my faith lies. So I think, if we can hold off the destruction, it's our job to learn from the past and certainly do all the organizing that we can, but basically to stop humans from destroying the future, and I do have faith that we can do that, in this way, in this way, in this way, in this way. It's not just one program, but I think if we can prevent humans from destroying the future, whether we're talking about the forests or the oceans or getting rid of plastics or dealing with the climate crisis, then the earth will survive, and there are species that will survive with the earth.
You are tuned to Fifth Estate Live, which comes to you every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. You can hear all the archived episodes at fifthestate.org in video and audio form. And if you subscribe to the Fifth Estate magazine, you have all kinds of possibilities of getting Peter Werby's latest novel, Summer on Fire, which is a fantastic novel about 1967. This is my favorite kind of commercial announcement, promoting Peter's latest novel. I'm totally fine with that. That's like, I do that when not prompted as well. It really is a great novel. But Karen, when we move up to the late 80s and you and Judy Berry and Daryl Turney and a whole bunch of other people were very much involved with building what became known, I think very intentionally, as Redwood Summer, and of course was interrupted horrifically by a bombing. But in terms of like the strategy of the movement at the time, it seemed like it was something of a new venture, right? I mean, to build something that was going to bring a lot of more people into the forest was the idea, modeled after the civil rights movement in the 60s and going to the South.
Yes, it was Earth First's attempt at mass organizing, really. And Redwood Summer was the brainchild of Judy Berry, who is a very dear friend of mine, and also and a cohort. I mean, we organized together here, but also just a brilliant strategist and organizer. And And she, one of the ways that she put it was, you know, looking to the civil rights movement in the 60s, she said, you know, one of the reasons when you look at all the atrocities that were happening, lynchings and, you know, churches being bombed and children being killed, and so much was happening behind the scenes outside of the public view, and that was part of how they got away with it. And so part of the strategy that, that people employed in the mid 60s was to bring college students down to the South to be organizers. So it was exactly on that model, because the organizing that we did was on college campuses, and we wrote up some material and sent it out to a lot of colleges through whatever routes we could all around the country. But then there was a roadshow tour. It was a fairly short roadshow tour, and it was it ended up being shortened by the bombing, but other people picked it up and still went to other college campuses in California. And so that was in the spring of 1990. And we had already been involved with the Headwaters Forest Campaign, which became a very important forest campaign in California, because it was old growth redwoods, and it was, you know, the classic corporate takeover of a family-owned logging company who had been logging fairly sustainably for 100 years, and they tripled the cut overnight and downgraded the worker safety issues and just went in to get everything that was profitable. So we'd been involved with that campaign, Earth First and Epic, who filed lawsuits, two very small organizations, for about 4 years. And so it was arriving at that point, we've got to do something else, because we're losing big, we're losing fast.
As you're so, waiting for the lawsuit. And I just want to point out that this financialization of the timber industry, it's of the period, like with Max Sam, it's the same thing that's now happening with the real estate, with real estate. But please continue. I just wanted to make a little note of that, this financialization phenomenon, you know, that like this, when like Max Sam and this liquidation of assets. Yeah,
it was a hostile takeover, and it was done with junk bond money, and had to do with the bankrupting of the savings and loans, and yeah, it was just such a classic story, which also, you know, besides our direct actions, got us a little bit of ink, because Charles Hurwitz turned out to be the classic villain. But it was Judy's idea to do mass organizing, and Earth First had, you know, there were a lot of people in Earth First who were kind of wary of that, because we're taking this stand saying no compromise, we'll do direct action, and everybody else compromises. And you know, it wasn't like today, where there's a million grassroots organizations that carry out direct action on all kinds of fronts. And so there was a fear of dilution, but it was also a good idea. So we embarked on that and got a lot of interest. And, you know, but it also is important, I think, to back up from the bombing a little bit when everyone talks about the bombing, because it, you know, yes, it took us by surprise. Judy was on a roadshow tour headed down to Santa Cruz, and we just had kind of a seminal Redwood Summer meeting at the Seeds of Peace House in Berkeley, and we decided this framework for the summer. We were going to do, you know, three big actions, and we'd set up the base camp, and we'd be prepared to feed hundreds of people and have constant action prep trainings and that sort of thing. And it was the next morning that the bomb that had been secretly planted under the seat of her car exploded and nearly killed her and injured Daryl Cherney, who was also in the car. And, you know, it was so horrendous that it, you know, in every way, it was very shocking. But we also, it took us by surprise because we didn't think we were that dangerous. We didn't think that we warranted that kind of response. We had been, the key organizers had been getting death threats up on the North Coast, and all the sentiment was being whipped up by the timber industry. And there were false Earth First press releases that had been posted in the laundromats and of the small towns and that real sort of thing. Pardon me?
Real psyops kind of stuff. Like, Cointel, real classic COINTELPRO kind of stuff. Sounds like.
Yeah. It was COINTELPRO with the corporations being part of the tools of the state. But, you know, it was already very politically hot, but for it to go to that length, because that was a bomb that was meant to kill, and the only reason it didn't kill Judy instantly was that it didn't explode with its full force. You know, we got to examine the bomb afterwards, and it part of the force went out the end, the cap popped off, and so all the force didn't explode up. Mm-hmm. Into her body from the seat, and if it had, it would have killed her. And then part of their plan was to blame Judy and Daryl for the bombing, and if Judy was dead, it would have been an easier task because they would have blamed Daryl as a jilted lover. And I mean, they had this plan. It became very clear that they had this plan. And they did arrest them right after the bombing for carrying a bomb. But backing up from that, you know, if we'd been paying more attention, it's hard to see how we could have been paying more attention, but at any rate, the COINTELPRO surveillance and dirty tricks didn't start in 1990. And a year before that, people had been busted in Arizona, what became known as the Arizona Five, and included one of the founders of Earth First, Dave Foreman, and four other people who were out on a monkey wrenching caper doing damage to a transmission tower that was pumping water over the hills to the Phoenix golf courses. And that action was set up by an undercover FBI agent. And through the course of that trial, we found out that, you know, they had poured literally millions of dollars into this undercover operation. And that particular person who drove them to the action and bought the acetylene torch and taught them how to use it and planned the action had been undercover with Earth First for 2 years. And, you know, when we found out that they had been coming to our annual Round River Rendezvous basically since the beginning. So it kind of, you know, culminated in the Arizona Five arrest and then trial and again, the bombing.
I just emphasize that this is something that the FBI is doing all the time. And every, I think, pretty much every case of so-called, you know, terrorist plots that have been busted over the past 20 years or that have been plots that were already being organized by agents that were all or in, you know, people who are infiltrating organizations, were in the case of like those people that supposedly were going to bomb the Sears Tower from Newburgh, New York. I mean, they didn't even have driver's licenses, you know. I mean, they were not in any, they couldn't find Chicago on a map. I mean, it's not to say anything, you know, it's just they weren't, that was not at all where they were going. This was all, you know, engineered, that's a fascinating element of the whole COINTELPRO and what they were obviously continuing to do in the 80s and up to the, you know, up to the present, whatever they call it. It's the same stuff they were doing in the 60s and 70s.
It is the same stuff because, of course, this all happened, you know, after COINTELPRO was supposedly outlawed. You know, the church committee hearings had happened long before that, and they found out what J. Edgar had been up to, and they said, no, you know, this is illegal, and they kept doing it just under a different name and a little more surreptitiously. But you know, one thing I will say, one thing that we did do right after the bombing was we kind of, you know, got a little smarter pretty fast, in that it was particularly because Judy and Daryl were immediately arrested and blamed for bombing themselves. We saw that, you know, this was COINTELPRO. And so one of our very first press conferences coming out to say, you know, these people aren't bombers. You know, we're organizing to save freaking 2,000-year-old redwood trees, for God's sake. But we invited representatives from the Black Panthers and the American Indian Movement. And every press release would mention the Black Panthers and AIM and the Puerto Rican Independentistas and the IWW and other groups who had been targets of COINTELPRO, because there's really no difference. And one of the reasons that we were taken by surprised so much was because we were white privileged environmentalists, and you know, somehow I think it would be different today. There was not intersectionality like there is today in our movements. Then we're still not where we need to be by any means, but we had not learned those things at that point, and so we took it for granted that we were fairly safe. And
yeah, right. And that's a mistake that so many of us make. We think we're not important enough, which is a nice humble orientation, if not accurate. You know, then in the late '90s, you know, people associate 99 and the WTO protests in Seattle and the shutdown of the WTO. You know, for a lot of people in the world and in this country, if they even know anything about it, and I meet a lot of people who are, you know, born around that time who have never heard of it. But, you know, then it sort of came out of nowhere, which, of course, it didn't. Right. And so much of the strategies, the tactics, and the idea of intersectionality, at least in terms of particularly in the sense of the common interests and other commonalities between, you know, not only humans generally, but Teamsters and Turtles, as the you know, famous you know, the well, for whatever reason, that's the those are the words that we kind of sum up that particular, you know, phenomenon of the green red alliance, as it's often known in countries where the color red is not associated with the Republican Party, but you know, in the rest of the world it means something different. But this whole phenomenon of trying to make an alliance between environmentalism and labor, and can you talk about that whole idea that you guys were really working on from very early on? Around, I mean, Judy Berry is also known as being an organizer with the IWW as much as she's known as affiliated with Earth First. And where did that all come from?
Right. Yeah, labor organizing.
15 minutes, but, sorry.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
That's how the time goes. See, you think I'm skipping ahead, but actually I'm looking at the clock. I'm like, okay, we're up to 99. Let's talk about that. You know?
But yeah, Judy's background was in labor organizing, and even, you know, when we went to Seattle, I mean, the Teamsters and Turtles has, you know, it has good rhythm, it has alliteration, but in fact, it was just before that, you know, it was Earth First and the Steelworkers, and we ended up forming a nonprofit called the Alliance for Sustainable Jobs and the Environment, and Earth First and the Steelworkers Alliance came out of the Maxam campaign because Maxam is essentially a holding company, and it owned Kaiser Aluminum that had plants in Spokane and Louisiana and Ohio, and it owned Pacific Lumber that was logging the redwoods in Northern California. And we kind of stumbled into each other. We actually heard from a steelworker, and they had just been locked out of the Kaiser plant in Spokane. And Daryl Cherney from the Redwoods campaign traveled up there and went to the picket line and talked to people. And we realized, you know, as different as we looked, we were mostly hippies in California. And, you know, there are these big burly steel workers. But we realized instantly, you know, we are you, you are us. We can fight together and be so much stronger. And we went to shareholders meetings together, and it scared the crap out of Charles Hurwitz and Maxam. Mm. And, you know, like we were marching through the streets and, in Houston, Maxam headquarters. And it was pretty funny because the chants that got, that we got going, I mean, the steelworkers were not constrained by any nonviolence code. And they had some pretty rowdy chants about bringing down Hurwitz and his corporation. But we, you know, we contributed mightily to each other's causes. And the head of the, I forget what it's called, the Regional Steelworkers Organization in Seattle, actually climbed the tree to visit Julia Butterfly when she was doing her 2-year-long tree sit. And so it was an amazing alliance and launched what came after that.
I just realized you were coming through the wrong speaker, but you can still hear me, right? I can say
yes,
something.
Yes, I can.
Okay, oh, good. Yeah. We've both been around kind of long enough that, I mean, you know, whenever I talk about the past, and I guess, you know, we all have this issue of like probably people thinking that we might be, you know, blowing things out of proportion it's the fish that got away, reminiscing about, you know, great times or whatever. But it's in my lifetime, at least having been sort of on the ground involved with stuff since the 80s on, you know, one form or another, that period around 99, 2000, when there was this, moment when it seemed like the environmental movement and the labor movement was it was focusing together on institutions like the IMF and the World Bank and the whole mm-hmm. phenomenon of basically capitalism. I mean, it was very exciting, and it seemed like it was kind of like destroyed in many ways by what came next after 9/11 and the wars and everything else. But was that your experience looking back at the past, I don't know, you know, half century of your involvement on the ground? Was that a particular moment where it seemed like these efforts were really starting to come to some kind of fruition, or am I just you know, kind of rose colored glasses here?
That point in time was.
Did it feel like the efforts of the ruling class to divide the social movements of the day were starting to fail, and that like it was looking like it, to me it was looking like what are they going to do? Like a lot of people are really condemning capitalism, and it's coming from a lot of different angles here, and it was looking like there were prospects. And the cat wants to be part of this discussion, obviously.
Yes.
The cat says, I'm hungry and I don't care about politics. I just caught a mouse. That's much more important.
Sorry about that. No
worries. It's great. That's a real pandemic quality interview.
Yes, yes. Well, I, you know, there's, I mean, people are figuring out in these days so much more how to come together, and you know, one of the things that I find is at Earth First gatherings, there's a lot of criticism of early Earth First, what people see as early Earth First, and it's partly because intersectionality is so important to people, and there's, you know, the last number of years at the National Earth First gatherings, I think that we've come, I mean, just to choose Earth First, you know, this is happening everywhere, obviously, but just that as one of my contexts, I think that we've made a lot of really positive strides. And in the pipeline campaigns, the alliances that are happening there have been a lot of positive strides made. And because people are grasping the importance of those alliances and of intersectionality as a concept, as a way of organizing and as a way of operating as a larger movement, then they tend to criticize the early days, and you know, I'm talking about like the people, the activists who were in their 20s and 30s, and I, you know, without being defensive, because I in every way embrace what is happening today, I tend to be a myth buster. Because people subscribe to a lot of myths about early Earth First, that it was, you know, all these cowboys, and you know, there weren't women around, and we didn't, goodness.
Cat says, what's this about interspecies?
And you know, there's it's true that there's a lot that we hadn't learned yet, and that's not to be excused, but you know, no more can we put the organizing and the strategizing that we were doing, say, in 1985, you know, just plunk it into 2021, any more than you know, we could put today's activities at some time in the future that we can't even predict. It's, you know, it's context can be everything. And we were operating within a context then. And the important thing is the evolution. And I think that that's really the only lens to look at the history through. And you know, in what I my attendance at the Earth First gatherings and the writing that I do, the work on the anniversary issue right now, and also the, you know, the book that I'm working on, it's about looking at the evolution. Here's
There we go.
the cat. She
I'm
just
going to try
jumped on
chewing
the
on the mic.
table right
What
next
is
to the computer. Yes, you're fine.
You know, when I think about some of the stuff you're talking about, like, I mean, it's something I've also had a lot of experience with, having been accused of pretty much every transgression I can imagine. You know, basically, I don't know, not everyone, but I mean, all the basic categories of transgressions, I think I've been accused of them. And you know, you know, sometimes it's true and other times it's completely whack, but you know, we're all sort of imperfect humans trying to make our way through this world, and it seems like when I think back to stories I've heard about and read about in the 60s, I mean, this whole criticism, self-criticism thing sounded absolutely like a nightmare for a lot of people, and I'm sure it was also in other ways very transformational in positive ways for a lot of people, but it sounds like it was just it drove a lot of people out of the movement and traumatized a lot of people, and none of that seems to have changed in the move in various movements. I mean, we're still engaging in, you know, these kinds of practices with all their whatever their pros and cons may be. And I would say there's probably lots of pros and cons, but do you have any thoughts on this whole question of how these how we treat each other in social movements?
Well, for one thing, I think that, you know, the discussions that I've had with the younger people about the you know, if we want to call them transgressions of the past, the lack of understanding of issues that, you know, some could say we should have understood. I don't think that we should waste a lot of time trying to fix the past, or even figure out the past. But I also think that the, you know, there are qualities to organizing. You know, when I look back on my decades of being in the Earth First Movement and other movements as well, there are things that I think are worth hanging on to, that include a robust irreverence, you know, when it comes to ourselves and everything else, and you know, while retaining respect for the things that do deserve respect, but an irreverence and an ability to make fun of ourselves, and the necessity of using art, using music, and finding the humor. Because that's, I mean, those things are, sometimes they can seem to have little to do with this very important agenda that we have to be serious about because it's so damn important and we don't have a moment to lose. But unless we are operating with those other qualities, we're not going to be as effective because we have to survive. We still have to survive in order to carry on the struggle.
And if people doubt the importance of being able to, of having art and things like giant puppets and banners and all this kind of, that gives people, well, it provides an atmosphere, but it also tells passersby what are these people doing and what are they about, you know, without needing to talk. You can, you know, see the puppets and you get some impression. But I remember it was there was a certain period of time when anytime there was going to be a big thing happening and there were people working on building puppets and stuff like that for the occasion, the puppet warehouse was often targeted before the events took place and on some kind of pretense, like a bomb that didn't exist. And they, you know, the police would arrest all the puppets. They did this in Philadelphia at the RNC in 2000. I can't remember how many other places. It was a frequent occasion. It wasn't just like a one-off. But yeah, it must matter because they're arresting the puppets. The puppets must be important. Otherwise, they wouldn't get arrested. So, I mean, I think it's worth noting.
Karen, right, and it's also something that the corporate CEOs hate is to be laughed at, and you know, it generates that as well. And one of the things that I've always loved about tree sits, which are amazingly seem to still be somewhat effective, there are several tree sits going on up in Northern California right now as we speak, and we just sent out a press release yesterday. It's great, but one of the things that tree sits do is that they get people to look up into the tops of the trees and have wonder and smile. Yeah. And that's worth a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Such beauty amidst all the horror when you're up in a tree, you just it's just amazing. Karen Pickett, it's been such a pleasure. Can't wait for that book to come out. And if they just earthverse.org, I imagine they can find out about the tree sits that are happening there in Northern California.
Yes, in God, I don't think we put it up on the Earth First. The Earth First Journal is in hiatus. There's an occasional Earth First Newswire post that comes out, and it's Earth First Journal .news actually. Oh, good. And these days, Yeah, there will be a post about those tree sits on there and directions to other groups.
Excellent. Thank you, Karen. Oh, there's
so much we didn't talk about. We didn't talk about so Marius.
So much. I mean, I basically failed to bring us into the 21st century entirely. We only covered that for the past 2 minutes. So, you know, if anybody's like looking at the interview arc here, it was like, you know, it didn't, you know, we needed another half hour at least, you know, but then let's do part two. I think we can definitely let's go. Do part two and talk about 2000 to the present. They can at least spend several hours on that.
Sure.
Yeah. Hope to see you again. Take care, Karen.
Okay. Thanks, David.
And thanks for everybody tuning into this discussion with Karen Pickett, longtime organizer with Earth First. And this has been another episode of Fifth Estate Live, which you can find in archived form at fifthestate.org in audio and video form. And you can also subscribe to the Fifth Estate magazine there as well and get a copy of Peter Werby's new novel, which is fantastic. All right, everybody. Take care. Bye for now. Remember, mutual aid will get us through. Don't trust the government, but do trust your neighbors. Bye-bye. Take care.